Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Last year, 70,237 people died from drug overdoses, according to a report just released by the Centers for Disease Control. That is almost 200 people every day. Overdose deaths in the U.S. are happening everywhere. The drug overdose epidemic started in the 1990s when opioid painkillers became a remedy for pain like back pain and arthritis. As today's guest, Chris McGreal, writes in his new book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts, the ascendancy of prescription painkillers was first driven by Purdue Pharma's OxyContin, the world's most powerful painkiller. Purdue Pharma unleashed a marketing campaign like no other to make OxyContin the go-to drug for pain treatment. Chris McGreal writes, "This tragedy began when Bill Clinton was president, surged through the years of George W. Bush, but only began to be given the attention it deserved when Barack Obama was wrapping up his second term. Even then, no one seemed to do very much about it. How was the greatest drug epidemic in American history allowed to grow virtually unchecked for nearly two decades with no end in sight?" Chris McGreal hones in on the role of Big Pharma as it poured millions of dollars into discrediting the evidence that mass prescribing was creating an epidemic. He also exposes how a greedy drug industry spent years co-opting and corrupting Congress, the Food and Drug Administration, and the medical establishment into colluding in this tragedy. Chris McGreal is a reporter for The Guardian and a former Guardian correspondent in Washington, D.C., Johannesburg, and Jerusalem. He's the author of the new book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts, and it focuses on how Purdue Corporation's OxyContin, the most powerful narcotic painkiller, has devastated poor communities. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Well, thank you so much for writing this book. You provide a tragic picture of how and why so many people have become addicted to opioids. We have these new numbers out. I mean, they're just shocking. Almost 200 people every day die from a drug overdose. You come at this from an interesting perspective because you grew up in England, and you come from a country with a publicly run healthcare service. And I understand that you've always been very struck how much medicine is run as an industry in the United States.
Yes, when I began to write this book, the two things that leapt out for me were the one you've already mentioned, how this had gone on for 20 years before anybody really paid it the attention it required. And the other thing was that the United States consumes 85% of the world's prescription opioids, which was just a stunning figure given that it's only 5% of the world's population. So, you know, I wondered why that was, why this was a uniquely American phenomenon for all intents and purposes. And one of the distinguishing factors with the United States is that health is run here as an industry. In most other countries, you have public health in some form or another, whether it's like Britain, where you have socialized medicine, or France, where you have very strictly controlled private insurance. In those cases, on the whole, the patient is the priority. I think in the United States, you have so many other forces at work, the interests of the insurance companies, the hospitals, the drug makers themselves, that the patient's interests often further down the list than they would perhaps care to admit. And it very much is run as an industry, yes.
And so talk about the importance of that, the fact that this is run as a for-profit industry. Health insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies constantly post wild profits. Their CEOs make millions and millions of dollars. Talk about the connections between that and this crisis.
Well, what you see that in the 1980s is a group of doctors who get together and they see opioids as a magic bullet, in effect, to deal with the widespread problem of chronic pain. And there is genuinely a problem. You know, doctors have long been frustrated by the fact that people who endure debilitating chronic pain, physically and mentally debilitating pain, that they haven't been able to deal with it. And this group of doctors said to themselves, there's an unnecessary stigma against the use of opioids, which goes back to another epidemic that that the United States had of morphine and opium that really grew out in the post-Civil War era. And from about a century ago, there was an increasing reluctance in the medical profession, backed by laws that made the prescribing of opioids more and more difficult. And these doctors looked in part to the UK, where the hospice movement in the 1960s had kind of unleashed morphine as a means of treating people who were dying of cancer pain. And one of the things about that, the hospice movement said, it really doesn't matter if cancer patients who are dying become addicted, because they're dying. When the hospice movement moved across to the United States, these doctors then pushed the idea that these pills could be widely prescribed, and they basically fixed the science, fixed the data, or certainly misinterpreted it at best, in order to deny there was a risk of addiction, to deny that there was a risk of dependency, and to overly claim the effectiveness of these drugs without the dangers. And at that point, the drug industry latches onto it. This is the 1990s, and the drug industry sees an opportunity, and it wades in, led by Purdue Pharma. But there were other drug companies and broader industry interests as well. And they wade in to promote and throw money into promoting the idea that drugs should be widely prescribed. And in essence, they end up taking control of medical policy through various institutions. They are able, through a body called the Joint Commission, which licenses hospitals, to essentially require doctors in hospitals to widely prescribe opioids as the first means of treatment for pain. That enters health systems across various states, and essentially the industry ends up driving the mass prescribing through its money of opioids.
Chris, you do an amazing job of reporting on so many of the most influential doctors in the 90s that really changed the game when it came to painkillers. And then, as you said, the doctors did that. They published various articles in important magazines, and it really took off. And then the drug industry latched onto that. So you've got two really interesting things happening at the same time. You write about so many doctors who wrote these articles that really, you know, got people going to the doctors to ask for these drugs. There's so many stories in this book. Which one really stands out for you, specifically about the doctors?
Yes.
Chris? Did we lose Chris?
The alarm bells quite early on.
Sorry, Chris. You're on Skype, right? I think we just dropped you. Can you just start over?
Yes, sure.
Okay, thank you.
In looking at why this had gone on for 20 years, I wondered why nobody had rung the alarm bells early on. And in my research, it became increasingly apparent that actually there are real heroes to this story, and they include doctors who warned very early on, within about 5 or 6 years of the OxyContin coming onto the market, that actually it was having a very debilitating effect on patients. One person who really springs to mind is a doctor called Jane Ballantyne, and she's head of health at Harvard at the time and its associated hospital, Massachusetts General. And she buys into the idea initially that these painkillers are safe and effective, and she starts prescribing them to her patients. But within a few years, she starts to notice that actually the patients are still constantly in pain. And in some cases, their pain's getting worse. And she also starts to hear from the relatives of these patients who are saying, you know, these drugs are changing them. Their personalities have changed. They look like they're addicted. Their lives are not improving. Even if they've got a little less pain, the quality of life is deteriorating because of these drugs. And Ballantyne does a study. She starts to gather the data, pull together the evidence, and she writes an article in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2003 saying all of this, saying essentially, you know, let's pause, let's think about what we're doing here. And one of the things that has, right through this epidemic, has been really lacking is studies and data. And she said, we need to look at this more closely. And other doctors did the same thing. There's a surgeon in Detroit who saw that his patients were dying of these drugs after they had operations. There's a doctor in Virginia, Art Van Zee, who saw the impact on his coal community. All of these people were ringing the alarm bell. And what happens at that point is that the industry decides essentially to change the conversation. It says, oh, well, yes, it may be true that some people are becoming addicted, and it may be true that these drugs don't work for everybody, but they are the abusers. They start to denigrate people who become addicted as abusers, to sideline them and to say, look, we need to keep these drugs flowing for the 100 million, the tens of millions of Americans who live with chronic pain. And essentially what the industry tried to do was to turn this into goodies and baddies, and to blame the people who became addicted, the victims, for their addiction, even though often, actually, they were the same people who'd been following prescriptions originally. And that worked for a number of years.
And as you write, this goes back to the mid to late 90s, and it's so important to focus on that, because only within the last, say, 5 years has this really gotten the attention it deserves. You mentioned Dr. Art Van Zee, and you write about him in your book. He runs a rural clinic in Virginia, and he said that he saw the first flickers of the epidemic in 1999 when patients began telling him about sons, daughters, and grandchildren suddenly hooked on a new drug, OxyContin. Within a year or so, the pill seemed to be everywhere. He said, quote, I'd probably seen 15 people who were opioid addicted in 25 years, and now there was this tsunami of people addicted to OxyContin. It was hard to find a family that wasn't affected very directly, end quote. I mean, that's just amazing. And as you write, again, this is in the late 90s. OxyContin took a hold of people's lives and turned them into thieves who stole from their own families and their neighbors to meet the cost of feeding an ever-demanding habit. It cost them their jobs, cars, houses, dignities, and sometimes even their children. I mean, we are hearing about these stories today, but as you point out in interviewing so many of these doctors and community activists, this was happening in the late 90s.
Yes, and I think the key is where it was happening. As you mentioned, Art Van Zee's in Virginia. He's in a western part of Virginia, very rural. A lot of this was happening in southern West Virginia. That's really the crucible, eastern Kentucky, parts of Maine. And certainly where this took hold and grew, these were marginalized communities, and they still are marginalized. The people were dying there. They're often stigmatized communities. I mean, as one man in West Virginia who I write about, Willis Duncan, said to me, you know, we were just dumbass hillbillies, and that's how they saw themselves and thought that they were regarded by the rest of the country. And I think when that addiction, which, as you say, you know, affected individuals, but also blighted entire communities and affected their economics and their social services. When it happened and began in those regions, they were really invisible to the rest of the country. And I suspect that in where it was seen, because of who they are, they were often blamed for their own condition. Mary Bono, who's a former congresswoman whose own son became addicted, and she became very active on this in Congress, has since said that she looked at what was going on in West Virginia and just thought, that's them, that can never happen to us. And I think there was undoubtedly that attitude amongst the people that were paying attention. But the truth is, most of the country just wasn't paying attention to those parts of Appalachia and New England.
And as we know now, this epidemic is everywhere. But when you were doing your research and you started this about 5 years ago, why did this start in places like Appalachia and West Virginia?
I think there's several reasons, but a primary reason is that when the drug companies looked at where they could sell this, particularly Purdue Pharma, which ran probably the biggest marketing campaign for that kind of drug ever run, when they looked at where painkillers in some form were already being taken. And if you look at that part of Appalachia, you have a lot of people who do physical, hard physical labor in the mines, you know, in logging, some in factories, wherever. And so they've long used some form of painkiller, whether it was, you know, in years gone by, moonshine or marijuana or other forms of pills. And so that's where they started to, the drug companies targeted their initial push to get doctors to dispense them. And once those drugs took hold there, once they were effectively unleashed, and a key part of this marketing is that they were marketed by particularly OxyContin as safe and more effective. And people just took them thinking they were no really different to what they were already taking. They weren't given any warning signs. Once they entered the communities, they essentially got passed around. They got used as your everyday kind of painkiller, and that's definitely what they weren't.
You have these incredible stories about clinics that were set up by doctors that had already spent time in jail, for example, and they were passing this stuff out like candy. Correct me if I'm wrong, but at one clinic, I think there were something like 4 receptionists who basically had the prescriptions written out with no name and no date. And the patient didn't even have to see the doctor. They just had to come in and pay a certain amount of money, like $100 or $150. And the line was so long outside the clinic before it opened. And they would get these pills on a regular basis. No doctor even had to see these people.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there's two kinds of doctors. There were definitely the well-meaning doctors who only got their information from the drug company salesman and thought they were doing the right thing. And that's the majority of doctors. But there was this minority of doctors who saw the opportunity to make very large amounts of money. And they were responsible for a very large number of the pills that eventually got out there. And there's a clinic in a town I write about in West Virginia called Williamson. And Williamson's a town of about 3,500 people. And there's a clinic in a warehouse there that's actually set up by a man who's just come out of federal prison for running a gay escort agency in Washington, D.C. And he's from Williamson. He goes back there. Appropriately, he's an undertaker. And he basically begins an ingathering of doctors that he thinks would prescribe, including the former doctor in the federal prison he'd just been released from. And they set about prescribing to anybody and everybody. And as you say, your patient would see the doctor the first time, pay $150 or $200 to see them in cash, and then they'd never see the doctor again. They just turn up every month with their money and get their prescriptions without ever seeing the doctor, which is illegal, by the way, particularly for the doctors to leave pre-signed prescriptions. And word spreads to other parts of the country where people want to get hold of these pills because they've become dependent on them. And this pill mill in Williamson has people coming from hundreds and hundreds of miles away from other states. And it opens at 10 in the morning, but they're lined up outside from 6 a.m. The town is full of out-of-state cars, and it just churns out millions of prescriptions. So much so that one of the doctors, a woman called Catherine Hoover, writes between 2002 and 2009, she writes more prescriptions than the largest hospital in West Virginia. And in 2009, that clinic in this tiny little town made $4.9 million just in cash. When the police eventually raid the doctors, they find money stuffed everywhere. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars lying around in houses and in safe deposit boxes, and millions of dollars in bank accounts. And it would just been a drug dealing operation, nothing short of that.
This is an amazing story. It almost reads like fiction. Whatever happened to Henry Vinson, the man who started this?
He's now living in Ohio, and he is, I spoke to him, and he insists he's a reformed man. He essentially denies everything. He says, oh, he just got the doctors in, and, you know, he's not a doctor. The doctors prescribed, it's their business. If they did anything wrong, and a number of them went to prison, so they definitely did do something wrong, how is he supposed to know? But it's clear that Henry Vinson has quite a good business mind and is good at spotting an opportunity. He ended up in prison for aiding one of the doctors in tax evasion. And so he did another 3.5 years, but he insists he's turning his life around, and he's doing a degree, I think, in business. He just essentially denies everything and insists that he's a good man.
Well, and as you point out, Chris, I mean, this is just one clinic. But in order for these people to get these drugs, you obviously have to have a pharmacy to dispense all the drugs, and then the drug maker has to send the drugs there. And, I mean, it's amazing to think about it, and that was just one clinic of how many, you know, at that point, were dispensing this many drugs.
That's right. And, I mean, I think, you know, if you want to see how well-organized it was as a conspiracy, and you only have to look at how they operated in tandem with the various pharmacies around. Now, the doctors knew that actually quite a lot of these prescriptions would be viewed as suspicious by legitimate pharmacists. So they specifically avoided those prescriptions going to, for instance, the Walmart just out of town. They came to a deal with a handful of pharmacies inside Williams, and all of which were individually privately owned. And all of the prescriptions had to go to these pharmacies. And of course, they made a killing too, literally. So much so that at the height of it, a new pharmacy opened on the main street, which became a drive-through, and people literally drove through to pick up their opioids and drove on. And the police would, you know, the FBI investigators described the line of cars down the road. And I think one of the interesting things that to me is that, you know, the law enforcement people I interviewed for this book, from the FBI, from the DEA, from the state police, you know, these are pretty conservative guys, and they're not inherently hostile to institutions or to big business. But they all talk about these operations in the same way. They call them drug trafficking operations, and they compare them to the cartels in Mexico. And they're not just talking about the doctors and the pharmacies. They're talking about the drug distributing companies. They're talking about the pharmaceutical manufacturers. They see them as one big drug trafficking organization working together.
And Chris, before we go to break, you thank a few local journalists in your book for speaking with you and assisting you and working with you. At that time, when this crisis was just taking off in the mid to late 90s, do you know what was the local media coverage like?
Well, some of it was very good indeed. There's a Lexington paper which essentially opened the eyes of a Republican congressman from Eastern Kentucky, Hal Rogers, who has been very vocal, one of the leaders in Congress on trying to get attention to this. And he worked hard, and it was very... he ran into lots of brick walls. But he credits their coverage of what was happening with OxyContin in eastern Kentucky in the early 2000s with opening his eyes to just what was really going on in his district. So I think there has been some very good coverage in parts of the country. And the reaction of the drug companies was very interesting at the time. They sought to discredit the individual journalists and put quite a lot of effort into discrediting them and their reporting by making out that they were sensationalizing. They also unleashed these groups that were supposedly independent patient groups, but were funded by the industry against the media to supposedly, you know, write letters to the editor and try and pressure people in other ways. This is before the advent of social media. But there has been very good media coverage. I think the national media coverage less so, with the exception of a reporter called Barry Mayer on the New York Times, who did an excellent job of exposing Purdue Pharma early on. I think this, like the communities themselves, remained invisible to the national media in the United States for a very long time.
Today we're speaking with Chris McGreal, a reporter for The Guardian, who is out with a new, very important book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. We just got some new numbers from the Centers for Disease Control last year 70,237 people died from drug overdoses. That is almost 200 people every day. Coming up after a break, we'll continue speaking with Chris about the role that Big Pharma has played as it's poured millions of dollars into discrediting the evidence that prescribing was creating an epidemic. We'll also talk about how the drug industry spent years co-opting Congress, and we'll talk about politicians that really were involved in all of this and did nothing to stop it. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
High drama on the high seas off the coast of Crimea.
This is a fight. This is a battle. This is a war in the heart of Europe that is between Russia and Ukraine.
The Senate puts more pressure on the administration for supporting the Saudis, and a Chinese scientist claims that he's created the world's first genetically edited babies. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
That's 1/2 hour from now at 11 a.m. right here on KALW. This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Chris McGrill, a reporter for The Guardian and a former Guardian correspondent. He's out with a new book called American Overdose: The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. And he asks why under this tragedy really began under Bill Clinton. It continued and surged through the years of George W. Bush, and then it only began to be given the attention it deserved when Barack Obama was wrapping up his second term. Why was this? How was the greatest drug epidemic in American history allowed to grow virtually unchecked? And if you have any questions for Chris, if you'd like to talk about pain pills and just the changes that you have seen over the last couple of decades, we'd love to hear from you. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call, 866-798-8255. There's so much information, Chris, when you look at the politicians involved in this who did try to do something, who didn't. There's many. As you write, it was not only Purdue who was trying to push its golden killer pill. The company had a lot of help covering its tracks. Rudy Giuliani, Eric Holder, and James Comey all helped Purdue by delaying investigations of the company as addiction and overdose rates rose rapidly in the 2000s. You write that Eric Holder, later recruited by Barack Obama as Attorney General, represented Purdue. The day a case was to come to court in November 2004, he agreed to a settlement requiring the drug manufacturer to pay West Virginia $10 million without admitting liability, which was a pittance. Before we talk about that specific case, what did Eric Holder do for Purdue?
Oh, well, he was their lawyer. As in all of these cases, I mean, this was a big legal suit between the state of West Virginia and Purdue Pharma. And this process goes on for a long time. There are negotiations between the state and, because it was a civil case rather than a criminal case, the state and the company, end up with a whole barrage of lawyers involved over quite a long time. And what Holder did was essentially wade in at the last minute and essentially seal the deal on the steps of the courthouse, that it, from the perspective of the West Virginia Attorney General of the time, Daryl McGraw, and he wasn't particularly happy with this, but essentially allowed the company to buy its way out of accountability with a financial settlement in which it essentially admitted nothing.
And what about James Comey?
Well, James Comey was worked within the Justice Department. There are various. I don't think we can really pin too much on James Comey. There was a legal case out of Virginia by a guy called John Brownlee, who was the U.S. attorney for the Western District of Virginia, and he was pursuing Purdue Pharma with a criminal prosecution. It's the only criminal prosecution of the company so far, and this is in the mid-2000s. And essentially, he looked at who was dying of opioids in that part of Virginia, which is also the part of Virginia that Art Van Zee is in, and he concluded that it was Purdue's marketing campaign which had created this mass addiction, and that marketing campaign was essentially fraud. It was making false claims for the drug being safe and when the company knew it wasn't, and that it was more effective when the company knew that it wasn't. So he pursued a criminal prosecution, and in fact there was a lot of pressure on him to curtail that prosecution. The company, you know, went behind his back. They went to the Justice Department. And at one point, James Comey calls him in to say, well, what's going on here? Why are you pursuing this company? And Brownlee says that at that meeting, Comey actually listened, heard him out, understood what was going on, and said, carry on. But there were definite attempts later on by Purdue Pharma to ensure that the criminal conviction itself didn't affect the company's ability to do business. And in fact, it was one of Comey's deputies that played a role in that. He put enormous pressure on Brownlee to stall the prosecution and then to water it down. And Brownlee, he says that he didn't bow to that pressure, but I think it had an effect in the sense that Purdue was eventually allowed to plead guilty through a shell company, through a holding company, which meant that although it was convicted of a crime, a federal crime, and although it paid a very large fine, $600 million, it would be able to go on selling its pill. Under American law, if a company is convicted of a federal felony, it can't do business with the federal government on the whole. And Purdue wanted to go on getting money from Medicaid and Medicare and the Veterans Administration and other federal funds. So they negotiated that, which kept the company selling the pills, and they negotiated to keep the executives responsible out of jail, even though they pleaded guilty. So it was watered down. The prosecution was watered down, without doubt.
You have story after story about the influence of money in politics. Just one other story. You mentioned Mary Bono, a former congresswoman. She co-drafted legislation that would have required the FDA to change the label on OxyContin to limit its use to severe pain. And as you report, Purdue spent heavily to lobby against the bill. It failed to even come to a vote. The American Academy of Pain Medicine opposed other measures, including an effort to have hydrocodone pills moved onto the same more restrictive prescribing schedule as oxycodone, and the American Medical Association mobilized against a law co-sponsored by Bono, the Ryan Creedon Act, requiring doctors to be trained to prescribe opioids. I mean, the power that these companies have over Congress continues to this day.
Yes, and one of the things I explore in this book, because I think it was a big question in my mind when I started to write it, which is, okay, we understand that the industry works as it does, and it's going to go out and try and sell pills. But, you know, where were the institutions that are supposed to protect ordinary Americans, who are supposed to look after the patients? And it's interesting that to me that when I go to places like West Virginia and I talk to people who became addicted, they're very open about their addiction because they're very angry. They feel that the federal institutions, the medical institutions who were supposed to protect them as patients, in fact, sided with the industry. And I think that's true. If you look at the number of institutions, there's organizations like the National Institute for Drug Abuse, which is a federal body. Its name implies it should have been involved, but it didn't get involved. SAMHSA, the first two words of SAMHSA are substance abuse. It didn't get involved. And then crucially, the Food and Drug Administration, which approved these drugs, allowed them onto the market, and also said how widely they could be prescribed. For what kind of pain, which is what Bono was trying to restrict in her bill. What you see in all of these cases is that these bodies either do nothing, or they fail to act, or alternatively, they are greatly influenced by the industry and what its its arguments, its positions on this epidemic. And it was very striking to me that the money, the influence of that money decided medical policy by federal institutions. And the FDA, I think in particular, failed to step up and do what it should have done, which is protect patients. Instead, it acted in the interests of the industry.
You write that the FDA official who oversaw the OxyContin approval process was Curtis Wright, and it was Wright, faced by calls by an FDA toxicologist for OxyContin to be subjected to a standard addiction and overdose test, sided with Purdue to ensure that no test was done, and within 2 years, Curtis Wright left the FDA to go work for Purdue.
Yes, I mean, you see a whole lot of interlinked things here, one of which is that revolving door, which you've just described. But you also see the direct rise of money from the drug companies into the FDA's coffers. So in the 90s, a system was introduced where drug companies had to pay the FDA to essentially test and license their drugs. And what happens is that the fees for this get larger and larger. And as a result, there are two effects, one of which is the FDA becomes increasingly dependent on this money for its budget, to the extent that it's now 60% of its working budget. And the other thing is that because the drug companies are effectively funding the FDA, it gives them a route to go round to Congress, where the drug industry spends $2.5 billion over the past decade lobbying. So they have enormous influence, and say to members of Congress, look, the FDA, it's not being efficient. It needs to change its drug approval processes. It needs to speed them up and to put pressure on the FDA. And what you see evolve over the years, and what some officials inside the organization admit, is it became, instead of a relationship between the regulator and the regulated, it was more like a business client relationship, where the FDA started to see itself as serving the needs of the industry. And there's one, I'll give you an example of just perhaps how blatant this could be, is that when the FDA approves any drug, but opioids in this case, it has a committee of scientists and doctors who make a recommendation on whether the drug should be approved and put onto the market. And in 2012, there was a drug called Zohydro. And by then, it was quite apparent that there was an epidemic. So understandably, the doctors and the scientists on this recommendation committee are asking the drug company about addiction, abuse, and this is a very high-strength drug. And they're not happy with what they're hearing. They don't think that this drug is necessary, and they think it can be misused and is highly addictive. And the senior FDA official on the panel, who happens to be head of the approval, the drug approval for opioids, wades in to say, no, that's not your consideration. You should be only considering whether this drug is any worse than any other drug opioid on the market. So if there's another opioid on the market, even if it's causing addiction and death, you have to approve this because, and this is the phrase that he used, there has to be a level playing field for business. And there was uproar amongst some of the doctors. They say, well, what you're saying is that the commercial interests of companies are more important than the public health. And in effect, that is indeed what the FDA was saying. The panel rejected that drug 11-2, and they even said it wasn't safe for the people it was prescribed to. The FDA still approved it.
Today we're speaking with Chris McGrill, a reporter for The Guardian. His new book is American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. If you have any questions or comments for Chris about this crisis, we'd love to hear from you. We've done several shows about this opioid crisis, and I feel like with every new author, there's been a few books written about this, but so much new information comes out. And we'll talk with Chris about what it will take to truly tackle this. We'll also talk with Chris about a piece that you just tweeted, Chris, the Sackler family. Their members face mass litigation and criminal investigations over the opioid crisis. They're the family that owns the maker of OxyContin. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. According to the latest numbers, 70,237 people died from a drug overdose last year. That is almost 200 people every day. And Chris, in your piece, chapter Pushback, you write, as the epidemic coursed from the indivisibles of Appalachia and Maine into middle-class communities and onto college campuses, the opioid makers worried that their efforts to blame the addicted and the dead for their condition were slipping out of their hands. We'll talk about that in a minute, but Greg has a question. Please summarize addiction and death by overdose rates over time for all top addictions by race, gender, net worth, or addicts, and compare it to other countries. I mean, we could do an entire show about that. Can you generally, Chris, just talk about how it has really changed over the decades and how it's expanded?
Yes. I mean, if you go back to the early 90s, there was really a very low level of opioid deaths, and to be honest, drug addiction deaths in general. And what you see is, as the 90s goes on and into the 2000s, you see drug overdose deaths move further and further up the categories causing death. And there's a man called Dr. Len Palazzi who worked for the CDC, and it was his job to monitor accidental deaths that didn't involve vehicle accidents. And he was the first one to fully understand what was happening here, because he started to look at the numbers at the CDC, and he saw that deaths, accidental deaths for almost for every other category had fallen year on year. As cars, or I guess it's not cars, but as everything else got safer, those deaths reduced. And he noticed that drug deaths were going up, and he couldn't make out why. At first, he thought he'd made a mistake and just got the statistics wrong. And eventually, he starts to contact coroners and discovers that it's opioid prescription pills. And you can see it surge over the years. But perhaps the most, I mean, as you say, there are lots and lots of different statistics. But I think one of the things that's most interesting is there's a gap that opens up. So in the 90s, people who die of drug addiction are pretty much from any category. They could be black, they could be white, they could be poor, they could be rich, they could be educated or not. The gap you start to see open up from that point can be marked in several ways, but one of them is on education. And there's two academics called Case and Deaton who've done a very thorough study of this, and actually are the ones to reveal it. They show that if you did not get a post-high school education, the chances of dying of an opioid overdose rose dramatically right through the 2000s, whereas it remained pretty steady, actually, for people who were who had a college degree or higher. The other thing that is really noticeable is that the demographics of who becomes addicted. And traditionally, in other epidemics, it's usually the young, because they experiment with drugs. But because a lot of this addiction began with prescribing, it's actually the middle-aged. That for a large part of the 2000s, the people who are most likely to overdose and die are in the 45 to 55 age range, which is really, really unusual. But they're the ones being prescribed because they're the age that you're more likely to have pain. And then the third thing that's really striking is that with every other epidemic, drug epidemic, they've begun in the cities and moved to the rural areas. This is exactly the opposite. It's begun in the rural areas, and then a decade later, it's moved to the cities. And the cities finally start to catch up after about 2010. But for right through the first decade of the 2000s, this is principally a rural epidemic.
And Chris, given that you are from England and there is a publicly run health service there, what happens in England when people are addicted? What kind of treatment and help is available for them?
Well, because it, again, it's a public health system, it varies. I mean, there's a greater emphasis, perhaps, than in parts of this country on what's known as medically assisted treatments. So you get other drugs, essentially, and some of them are opioids themselves, but they're low level, to help you through coming off through your addiction. And some people are on these for a very long time. That is the most likely case. Now, in the United States, you know, they follow other programs, including 12-step abstinence programs, and the evidence seems to be that they don't work quite as well. You're more likely to fail on those. But I think, you know, in the UK and in most other countries in Europe, the striking thing is the much lower levels of addiction in the first place, rather than any great success in treating addiction compared to the United States.
And Chris, we've got about 5 or so minutes left. I wanted to ask you about the Sackler family and mm-hmm. Purdue. I mean, they're getting a lot more attention today because people are making the connections. And this is a multi-billion dollar family that owns Purdue, and they make the painkiller OxyContin. In your research, you write about the various family members and the lengths to which they would go to market these drugs. What really stood out for you when you did the research on the Sackler family?
Well, a couple of things is you know, they have a very interesting background. And the two brothers that essentially run the company that produces OxyContin, Purdue, they had got their medical education, or at least the beginning of it, in Britain, in Glasgow, because they were from a Jewish immigrant family in New York. And in those days, the 1930s, New York medical institutions had quotas on Jewish people training as doctors. And so they got on a ship and went to Glasgow and went to medical school there, just as the Second World War broke out, as it happens. And so the family has maintained a foot in both places, in the UK as a result, and in the United States. And I think what really leapt out to me about them was they were doctors, they were psychiatrists. They had been briefly in the 1930s members of the Communist Party, but they essentially were marketing men in the end. I think that's what's so striking is they had an older brother called Arthur Sackler, who wasn't involved with OxyContin. But he had been the man who'd essentially marketed Valium to Americans. And he'd done it by not targeting those who would have been prescribed it anyway, but targeting a whole wider range by basically widening the pool of people who might take Valium by persuading them they needed it for their nerves or whatever, when they didn't really need it at all. And the two younger brothers who run Purdue Pharma, they essentially take that model. And that's the key thing about OxyContin is if it had just been marketed to people who really did need a relatively high strength painkiller, and there are those people who do definitely need it, that would have been one thing. But the marketing memos show that they want to widen this beyond people with terminal cancer pain, and they want this to make this the drug to go to and to stay with. They actually say this, and I think that's what's so striking about the conscious effort to just get this drug into as many hands as possible, not those who really need it, just market it to everybody. And that's really, I think, what leaps out to me about those two Sackler brothers.
And your colleague at The Guardian, Joanna Walters, recently wrote a story called Sackler Family Members Face Mass Litigation and Criminal Investigations Over the Opioid Crisis. And she reports that Suffolk County on Long Island recently sued several family members personally over the overdose deaths and painkiller addiction. Prosecutors in Connecticut and New York are considering criminal fraud and racketeering charges against leading members of the family. Paul Hanley, a New York City lawyer, says this is essentially a crime family, drug dealers in nice suits and dresses. What are your thoughts on this? Where do you think this could possibly go?
I don't know where it'll go, and I don't know that criminal prosecution. There's one son, Andrew Sackler, who continues to play a role in the company, and he did back then, and he may be vulnerable. I think it'll be a harder thing to stick anybody else in the family with the criminal prosecution, because the two brothers that set this up are both dead now. One died last year and one died in 2010. But I think it comes from a place, a lot of anger in a lot of communities that are affected by this, that for years and years, Purdue Pharma, drug distributing companies, other opioid manufacturers have effectively bought their way out of justice. They, whenever they face legal trouble, they simply pay a civil settlement. And as one prosecutor put it, you know, they view it as the cost of doing business, and it doesn't really change their business practices. And I think there's a lot of anger and a feeling that although there's hundreds of lawsuits now against all kinds of drug companies involved in this, and some people think it's going to be a settlement, the final settlement will match the big tobacco settlement over smoking. There's a sense that individuals who knew what they were doing, who were effectively pushing what the DEA calls heroin in a pill, OxyContin, should be held to account. The mayor of Huntington in West Virginia, which is a town that was at one point the worst hit in the country with drug overdose deaths per capita, I did an interview with him recently where he specifically calls for them to be prosecuted. He describes them as drug dealers in Armani suits, and he says, you know, that financial settlements, if these guys walk away with the millions of dollars that they've pocketed in personal salary payments and bonuses, then they got away with it. And he wants to see people go to jail. And he's not the only one. I think there's a sense that if it's just a matter of civil settlements, then all of this kind of thing could happen again.
Chris, we have about a minute left. I mean, it is shocking to think that 200 people, almost 200 people will die today from a drug overdose in the United States. Where do you see that going? I mean, the numbers just continue to increase.
They do. Now, that's partly because of the introduction of fentanyl, this very high-strength drug. Now, right. But that hasn't come in a vacuum. That's come on the back of the addiction created by the prescription opioids. And I think one of the things that's worth bearing in mind here is that although fentanyl now accounts for about 30,000 deaths a year, prescription drugs are still accounting for about 15,000 deaths a year, and they have been for a number of years. So fentanyl may be overshadowing, but the prescription opioid deaths have not gone away. And so I think it suggests two things. Clearly, we need a lot of money to help treat those who are addicted, but also we still need to tackle the mass prescribing of opioids. In 2012, the peak, there were 255 million prescriptions for opioids written in this country, one for every adult. Last year, there were 192 million. So there's been a fall, but it's not that big a fall. And there's still very, very large numbers of pills being prescribed. And that risks creating a new wave of people who will move on to heroin and fentanyl and other drugs.
Well, Chris, we would love to have you back. Thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Chris McGreal is a reporter for The Guardian, and his newest book is American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. You can find more information about his work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.